Riley.
I don't think we're getting all the same. Unusual.
May it please the court, Kurt Temple on behalf of appellant Terrence L. Riley. Mr. Riley appeals from a final judgment from the United States District Court of the Northern District of Indiana from a conviction for possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine. We submit that conviction was the direct result of an error by the district court in failing to instruct the jury to disregard certain testimony which the government elicited from Detective Wise on the first day of trial. That testimony related to a purported admission by Mr. Riley with respect to the crack cocaine in open court. At that time, when the testimony was elicited, Riley's counsel objected to the testimony. He asked that he approach the bench and objected to the testimony, whereafter a bench conference took place. A bench conference was quite lengthy and consisted of almost 5 pages of transcript. And in the course of that bench conference, the judge ultimately ruled that that testimony was inadmissible. However, on returning to trial before the jury, there was no instruction given to the jury to disregard that prior testimony given by Detective Wise.
And there was a request by defense counsel to give that?
No, there was not. There was a lengthy bench conference where they discussed the merits, and in fact, there was confusion about when this testimony had taken place, and the judge had requested a transcript of that April 27th hearing. So the counsels and the judge were going back and forth about the testimony and the context of the testimony, and counsel did not request a limiting instruction. Could he? Yes, he could have, but there's a lot of could-haves and should-haves and would-haves with respect to this. One being, should the government...
So he didn't request it at that time, and then once the transcript was given to the district court, there was no request at the conclusion of the trial. So in other words, in just the other instructions, I understand that the one instruction that was submitted, the pattern jury instruction, was rejected by the district court, but there was no instruction tendered regarding this April 27th that the jury should disregard any testimony relating to that.
That's correct, Judge Williams. And in fact, there was an instruction given that the jury was to consider certain purported statements made by Mr. Riley, and that was an instruction number 11, which Mr. Riley's counsel objected to on the second day of trial, and specifically for the reason that because it could have related to the statement that we were talking about here, the one involving the purported admission. And then the court said, well, the government wants it in because Mr. Riley also made a statement that he was Quantrell Ward. And so then there was a discussion about the merits of the Quantrell Ward and in its relation to instruction number 11. So there was a specific objection, again, to that instruction within the context of Riley's purported admission. So once the objection was sustained on the first day of trial, trial resumed, and the government proceeded to admit a stipulation that Riley was a convicted felon. So the jury's now heard an admission. Now they heard he's a convicted felon. And then the court comes back at the close of evidence on the first day of trial, revisits the issue about its understanding of the April 27th testimony, the purported admission, and says, I need some authorities, but I'm going to keep it out because I think he was trying to get his girlfriend off. And so then trial ends for the day. They come back on the 16th. They again revisit that issue. And again, the judge specifically ruled that, well, this took place in the context of plea negotiations, and Mr. Riley wasn't aware that this could be used against him at trial. Not only was it used in the context of the plea negotiations, but it was also used at a pre-trial conference, and that's violative of Federal Criminal Rule 17.1.
Just tell us about the instruction he gave.
Well, the instruction he gave is interesting. I mean, are you talking about instruction number 11, the one I was referring to previously?
Yeah, just your
okay. Well,
until you got diverted.
Well, the court instructed, evidence has been received concerning a statement to have been made by defendant. It is for you to determine whether the defendant did in fact make that statement. If you find that the defendant did make the statement, then you must determine what weight you feel the statement was deserved. And in determining the weight, you should consider all matters and evidence having to do with the statement, including those connected concerning the defendant's personal characteristics and the conditions under which the statement was made. Well, that's instructing the jury, consider that statement that Mr. Riley made that came in through the testimony of Detective Wise, and also consider the context in which that statement was made. He made it in court. And that's what the testimony of Detective Wise was. April 27th, in court, Riley admitted to the crack cocaine. Now, if that's not error, I don't know what is. And the court, as the ultimate gatekeeper of the evidence, had the opportunity to provide an instruction to disregard the testimony. We're not dealing with a case where an instruction was given and then we're worried about the effect of that instruction, because we're pretty clear on where the court is on that. But here, no instruction was given limiting that or telling the jury to disregard it. Instead, we compound it. We tell the jury.
Let me ask, and the defense counsel didn't ask the judge to alter that instruction you just read to us with respect to the statement.
That's correct.
He did not ask. I mean, when the court determined that some type of instruction would be given, because you said there was another statement that the jury properly considered, right?
That's right.
So was there any alternative presented to the district court by defense counsel to modify the language of that instruction?
I don't believe there was. So we have this testimony that's out there, and it's the court has not only failed to give this instruction, but it also has told the jury that they are to specifically consider that instruction. And I think this is particularly damning, given the fact that the evidence on with regard to Riley's possession of the cocaine was thin, as the district court described it at one point. We're dealing with the possession chart, with the possession issue. We're only dealing with the issue of constructive possession. There's no testimony that Riley was holding the drugs or handling the drugs. So we're dealing with a nexus issue, and whether Riley or not Riley had the authority to exercise dominion and control over those drugs.
Did the jury ever hear the substance of Riley's confession?
No, they didn't hear the substance. They just heard that testimony of Detective Wise.
Well, did they hear the substance of it? That's what I'm asking.
Yes, they did. They heard.
Or was
it
confusing, or was it clear, or was it direct?
Well, I think it couldn't be any clearer. The words that were used was the words that were used, and it was based on leading questioning by the government.
The court excluded Riley's confession. Is that right?
That's what the ruling was.
Right.
But that's the tantamount to closing the barn door behind the horse after the.
We heard that before.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting comment.
Should the confession been excluded?
I think it should have been.
Why?
I think the judge's ruling was correct on that. It was because it came about in the context of not only, as the judge mentioned, plea negotiations. There were plea negotiations out there, but it was also in the context of a pretrial conference, and there's no dispute about that. It was set up for a pretrial on April 27, 2000.
Well, but confessions can come at any time. I mean, that's not necessarily excluding it.
But the judge also made a determination that it was inherently unreliable. He said it was like he's trying to get his girlfriend off. So he made a determination on a number of bases to exclude that. And once he made that determination, he should have gone back and tried to get the horse back in the barn. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Baker on behalf of the United States. I believe the evidence in this case is more than sufficient to establish the defendant's possession of the crack cocaine. In fact, it's overwhelming. In the middle of the afternoon, 1:30 in the afternoon, the police enter this house and find the defendant in a bedroom, clad only in his shorts, no socks and shoes, with a woman clad only in her underpants.
What's that got to do with the crack cocaine?
It shows the intimate relationship and the length of time the man's been in a house with freshly cooled cocaine on next to the bed with a fan blowing on it.
How their dress does?
Pardon me?
How their dress does?
I think it shows that he was not a casual visitor to the house, that the fact that he's in that relationship with her, in that bedroom, in that state of clothes, with freshly cooked crack cocaine sitting with a fan blowing on it a foot from the bed that also contains $21,000, I think is overwhelming evidence of his involvement with that crack cocaine. In addition to that, his pictures are all over the house, connection with her pictures. On plain view in the kitchen is a stirring stick for the crack cocaine, Ziploc bag. It's a gun on the headstand of the bed in the room they're in, and he's in that state of the people are in that state of dress. There's a gun on the headboard of the bed. There's a police scanner on the headboard of the bed. As I said, $21,000 on that bed. The house is a veritable fortress with an iron gate in front of it that the police had to remove to get in. There's a high privacy fence around the house. The defendant arrives in her car 2.5 hours before the police entered, has to drive through the garage to get into the yard, put the car in the yard where the surrounded by that fence. And he's in that house for 2.5 hours. The police chemist testifies it takes very little time to cook crack cocaine. I submit overwhelming evidence of his possession of it. He lies to the police about who he is and then gets nervous and wants out of there when they tell him they're coming with a police dog. That's he's got an identification card in the name of Quantrell Ward. In Barbara Harris's papers in the house, there's a receipt in the name of Quantrell Ward from Chocolate City Wheels. There's also in the papers in that bedroom his picture ID when he was in the detention center in Allen County with his picture on it, as is the picture on the Quantrell Ward ID he carried. In addition to that, 2 days before that, the police searched the garbage of the house. They find a stirring stick with just like the one that's on the counter with crack cocaine, with cocaine residue on it, a kilo wrapper from kilo cocaine wrapper, and a carry-out food box with Terry written on it, the defendant's nickname. I don't think there's any question in this case. The evidence is sufficient. In fact, it's overwhelming, and we believe that any error in connection with the admission of the statements, the testimony which consisted only of, now are you aware of any statements the defendant had made with regard to his admission to this particular crack cocaine, came into evidence without any explanation of what that statement is. The statement that that's mine, I did it all, was never heard by the jury. The defendant never went back and asked the court to strike that, tell a jury they couldn't consider it either.
What was the response to that question?
The response was he was aware of it, yes. The response was a simple yes.
And then he was asked when and on what
Then
date?
He was asked when was that April 27th of this year, and he said 2000 in court.
Right, and let me go to that April 27th date because he was asked by the court, his lawyer and the court asked him not to speak, but there was no discussion at that time of his right to remain silent or the implications of him speaking at that time, the fact that that statement could be used against him later at trial.
It was correct that there was no statement that it could be made, that it could be used against him, but it was completely voluntary. It wasn't the product of interrogation. Nobody was asking him to speak. Everybody told his attorney and the court told him not to speak, basically. He understood that what he was saying was incriminating because he said, if that makes me guilty, I plead guilty. And that reference that in the government submits is not part of a plea discussion. The judge wasn't participating in any plea negotiations. That was a statement designed to get his co-defendant off and assume the guilt for the drugs. And he knew it did by saying, if that makes me guilty, I'm pleading guilty, means he knew it was incriminating, not that it was part of plea negotiations. But in any event, in view of the overwhelming evidence, the admission of those preliminary statements and the fact that they weren't struck was harmless error by any way to look at this case.
All right, counsel.
Well, Judge Lee recognized that that there was some plea discussions out there at the time, and that Riley was going to potentially plead guilty to this.
Why isn't this harmless error?
It's not harmless error because it affects his substantial rights. It carried the day at trial. It carried the day.
What do you mean it carried the day? With a gun there, cooking cocaine.
Well, I admit that's damning evidence that there's drug dealing going on at that house. It's damning evidence that
$21,000
possibly Miss Harris was dealing drugs from that house. What did they have linking Terrence Riley to drug dealing at that house? What did they have other than the fact that he was there? And there was testimony of why he would be there. He had a child with Miss Harris. It was his girlfriend. I mean, to expect that, you know, he wouldn't visit her, I mean, then he wouldn't be doing his fatherly duty. So he had a reason to be there. It wasn't necessarily that he was dealing drugs. What did they have linking Riley to the drugs and the drug dealing? There was no fingerprint evidence. There was no fiber evidence on the male clothing that they had. What they're saying is, well, there was pictures of Terrence Riley there with Miss Harris. Of course there were
no
pictures.
There was no fiber evidence on the clothes, except the fact he didn't have any clothes on.
Well, there was testimony. It was also August 27th.
He walked in without any clothes on, you're trying to tell us.
I don't think he walked in without any clothes on. I think he took his shirt off or whatever he did. But it was August 27th.
There were no clothes there. Weren't there men's shoes there and everything else?
There was. And there was also testimony about Quantrell Ward.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and proceed to case.